history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are individuals where you live with some stories to tell. Sometimes it's just a matter of taking the time to listen, and that's what we do here on this program. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And boy, what things we learn. We are educated or entertained and inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As we mark Memorial Day weekend, we're going to hear the story of two brothers. They both served in World War II and both came home from that war. One of them had to go to Korea and never did come back. We'll hear from the surviving brother, Doug Justice of Visalia, California. He's 90 years old now.
You're born in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Family of 8 kids.
Right. 5 girls, 3 boys.
So you guys were outnumbered.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight for dinner?
No. When they sat down at the table, you couldn't just get all you wanted. Yeah. In fact, actually, Mom would serve you, really, because it had to go around.
But you were pretty young. You were just 4 years old when your family packed things up and moved out to California?
Yeah, that was everything closed down, you know.
Because of the onset of the Depression.
Yeah.
The stock market crash in 29 and all of that.
Exactly. Everything closed down. Indiana had a lot of factories, you know, and it shut down. And then the school was cut back real big on people's wages and things, you know, trying to keep their head above water.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad went to work for a club down there for people that had the means to belong to these big clubs.
Mm.
He went to work for them and was a chef there for...
He had been working at Purdue University?
Yeah, he had been doing their diet stuff for the athletes.
Uh-huh. He has to come all the way out to California for work. What was that like for you as a kid to grow up in Southern California before it was a house at every 10 feet?
Well, where we lived in Monrovia, we're kind of up. You could kind of look out over the city a little bit. You could see, you know, most of it was, you know, orange groves and avocados and things like that. And then, of course, the observatory was there close to us, and we'd walk over there as kids or ride our bikes. That was a big thing for us.
Tell me about your brother, Bert. I mean, he was 4.5 years older than you. Was he showing you the ropes a little bit? Were you watching him? Were you guys close? Did you squabble? What was it like?
Well, yeah, we kind of growed up together, you know, him taking the lead, like going getting them vegetables down at the dock. And my mom wouldn't let me go by myself. And he took charge of that kind of leader for me and my younger brother and sister. They were twins. And my mother had twins at 42 years old there.
Oof.
And anyway, he was my idol, like, you know.
You looked up to him.
Yeah, I did. I did look up to Bert. He was really nice. He guided me through a lot as I growed up. But, of course, he was that older, and he was, you know, going to school. And then my folks rented a big old farmhouse out on Long Beach Boulevard and started a chicken dinner house.
Huh.
So we all worked, and my mother planted the berry vines to make the pies and kill their own chickens, you know, things like that for the dinner house.
What was your job?
My job was with Bert. We'd go out and cut the chickens' heads off. He did one by one. Well, he made a guillotine that just stick like 6 chickens' heads through there and, you know, and that kind of stuff. He was always that way. We did good. We had a good life there, and folks did pretty good at the restaurant.
What was it called, the restaurant?
The Chicory.
On Long Beach Boulevard, you said.
There was 10 acres there. And the only people that ate in the restaurant was what really helped them was the people that had means and money would go to Long Beach Harbor and with their boats or yachts and things, you know. It got kind of well known. Mm-hmm. They would tell their friends and so forth. The first customer that I can remember was Randolph Scott.
Mm, movie star.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He was going down there, and he stopped and had a dinner at my place, at my folks' place. He pulls up in there, and my youngest, Alberta, she was probably 26 or something. Anyway, she was waiting tables. He pulls up in there, and he had this powder blue Lincoln Continental. She says, "Oh, what a pretty car." She waited on everything. He got ready to go and pay his bill. He said, "Would you like to take a ride?" So he took her around in that car. Then on, you know, he told his friends, and then we had a lot of them come through there.
All the Hollywood stars were eating at the Chicory.
We had not all of them, but there was, you know, like James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart. There was two or three more, and they'd stop on their way back from their yachting, you know,
yeah. And
that kind of thing. And it was good, but then some doctor bought that 10 acres, and he had a good reason because he sold it to Sears and Roebuck, and they built a big store there.
So that put you guys out of business.
It put us out of business. I did a lot of work in that 10 acres when we were there, my brother and I. The man would cut the hay. My brother and I, when it dried, would load his wagon. My brother was taller and bigger than me, so he'd pitch it up there, and then I would stomp it down and that kind of stuff. And we got, you know, paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, not much, but something.
So you and your brother were quite a team. Sounds like you did a lot of things together.
Yeah, we did. We really did.
Did Bert go into the service before Pearl Harbor?
Bert went in the service in 39.
What was that like for you? Was that kind of hard to see him gone?
Oh, yeah. You know, he was my big brother, and boy, going to be an Army man. And he went, and it wasn't a work. So you either did that or you couldn't do it, you know. And he wanted to work, and so he went in the Army in 39, and they sent him back to Fort Benning and made a first lieutenant out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And artillery. So he was, you know, in there before. Well, of course, Hitler was carrying on over there.
But America wasn't in the war yet.
Nope.
Until the day that all changed. And yeah. I bet you remember something about December 7th, 1941.
Well, yeah. You know, it was amazing. It was a big thing. The Japanese had been fighting wars for 20 years. They had a big army. They mm-hmm. were well equipped. And we didn't have beans, you know.
And you're 16 years old.
Uh-huh.
What do you remember about that Sunday? I bet you guys went to church.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. We always went to church. There was no doubt about that. There was no doubt about that. Of course, you know, Bert then was been in the service, so that got jacked up and, you know, more activity and things going on. He was stationed in artillery in San Luis Obispo. I had a little 1930 Ford coupe. And so my mother wanted to go see him. So we got in that little car and drove to San Luis Obispo. And so that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove there and seen Bert and visited with him and left home. That's when I first seen him in a real uniform, you know. And then I got in the service in 43.
What made you decide to get into the service? Or did they decide for you?
Yeah. I come home and my mother says, "You have a letter from the War Department." 18 years old. I never knew nothing about bad stuff. So time for me to go. And my mother walked me down to the red car. Mom's put me some clean underwear in there. And so, you know, I said, "Mom, I don't think, you know, oh yeah, you have to do this. Be now." And she told me all the things. "Now be yourself. You know right from wrong." You know, and told me all this stuff. And she walked me to the red car line, had still her apron on, and goodbye.
What was the biggest adjustment you had to make? What was the hardest thing to get used to?
I think the hardest thing was losing my contact with my parents and my friends.
So where was Bert this whole time?
He was in Europe, and that's where they sent him, because the artillery, you know, big time mm-hmm. over there. He went through the whole shebang for as long as it lasted.
Were you hoping you could end up where he was?
No, you know, I didn't. I didn't think about it. But the time that I went in, the Japanese were just killing us. We didn't have anything out there to protect them. You know, they still had World War I's equipment, guns and stuff, you know, no automatic stuff, anything, you know. And so they were just running right over the top of us because there was nothing out there to stop them. And so they were really, really needing boots on the ground.
Army needed bodies, and they needed them now.
And they needed them now.
Yeah.
And so I went through my basic training.
Yeah.
At Camp Roberts. When I finished my basic training, the lieutenant that was in charge of our company there come to me and a kid named Bob Simone. "You guys ought to sign up for this new thing they're starting. Going to be a special team or something." And so, oh, yeah, we'll do that, you know. Got into this unit, and when they were in sand dunes over there on the coast, and we trained in that sand, went in the ocean with rafts and tried to sneak on shore and not be seen, all that kind of stuff. Good, yeah. A lot of fun, kid play, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then they tried, they were going to form a glider.
Glider tank. Infantry?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, it didn't work. They didn't have enough big open spots where we were training. The kids were flying those things, you know, or you hit the ground and it didn't last, you know. They're killing too many guys, you know.
Just in training. Mm.
You know, the one I was in, they had that little 37-whatever-meter cannon, and it broke loose and just killed a young kid that was flying that thing.
You were in the glider?
Yeah.
You're in a glider, and they've got a cannon that they're going to take in the glider, and then you land and bust out the cannon.
Yeah, you're supposed to get the cannon out and set up. And anyway.
So another guy on the glider you're on gets killed in training.
Yeah, he got killed.
Did that make you think you're doing something dangerous?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, but I really didn't ever think about dying or I didn't never entered my mind. That was probably the first guy I seen, you know, get killed. So we did all that kind of training, and then they sent us to Camp Stillman up in San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
And we started jumping off the towers, low parachute stuff, never in an airplane. We jumped and we jumped and we trained and we trained and we jumped and we trained. Our captain was a nice man, young, strong. You know, after we'd been training for a month or two, I'd go into his office every Friday and I'd ask for a pass to go home to see my family. Nope, we may be going out here any day.
Hmm.
Nope, can't go now. And I went in this time and I walked in the door and he looked up and he said, blinkety blank, justice, here, go see your parents. He gave me the pass. I ran out that gate. I got on that milk train. You know, I just barely got home in time to say, hi, Mom and Dad, and run back and try to get home. And I came back, and I ran real, because I was going to be late. And I ran back, and I ran through the gate, and the guard said, hey, ho, ho, ho. No, I just kept running. And I ran to our barracks. Everything was gone. All the cots were rolled up, you know, except mine. I said, what the heck? So I ran to the headquarters there, asked them about it. Well, they're shipping out. I said, well, where are they? Well, they're down on the dock. So I just take off running down, and there they are, loading all these trucks, taking them to the docks, you know, to ship them off. And I come up to my lieutenant that I would think. I didn't get to see my captain, but I was coming to the lieutenant, you know, I said, hey, he says, you can't go. I said, what do you mean I can't go? I, you know, I'm here, and I am going. No, you can't. You're not coded. So they took off and left me there. So I stayed there by myself for, I don't know, month. I just played basketball every day, shot loops, just that kind of stuff to kill my time. Slept in the barracks all by myself. One day a lieutenant was going by and he come over to me. He says, what's your outfit? And I said, well, they left her over there. He said, what are you doing all day? I said, I'm just hanging around here, going to the chow when it was time in somebody's chow and that kind of stuff. And so 81st came in from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. That's how you ended up in the 81st Infantry Division.
Exactly.
But I know everybody listening is saying, well, what about those other guys? If you hadn't gone home to see your parents and you had been shipped out with that other group, where did they go and what happened to them?
My only thinking, I can prove it or nothing, they were a decoy for MacArthur coming back to the Philippines.
Mm.
As far as all I know, I looked and tried to find in the Stars and Stripes, I know everything to see what happened to him. What I had heard, and they went to Manila and did a low jump, and they got slaughtered. Bob, my friend I was telling you about, was from me and another boy. I don't know how what they answered to those mothers and fathers. Both of those boys' mothers would call me and write me letters and say, what happened to my son? What happened to this? And I wasn't there to tell them nothing. But I think that that was their mission that they'd been training for all that time.
Do you know what the unit was called? Or?
We had none. We had no patches. We had nothing. And so I don't know what that was.
The most you ever heard was that they jumped behind enemy lines in the Philippines.
Yep.
Ahead of the lady landings.
Yeah. That's the stuff you heard. You know?
So the implication is, had you not gotten that pass to go see your parents,
I wouldn't have been here.
You would have been killed in that jump.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt in your mind.
No doubt in my mind. I would have been killed because there was no survivors. You know, I'm sure some of them got captured, but there was no survivors that I ever heard of.
This was a pretty small unit?
There was probably 300, 400 guys.
Really?
Yeah. That was tough.
I'll say, but tougher times were still to come for Doug Justice in World War II. We're going to hear about that. And also his older brother, Bert, and the unique way Doug got to honor Bert's legacy through the Honor Flight program. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.